Before we start tonight, I would like to ask the Holy Spirit to come and join us. The topics here can be at times mentally challenging, and we would do well to ask for assistance. Our dear Heavenly Father, you have said where two or three are gathered together, there you are. We claim that promise tonight because we definitely need your presence with us. And the Holy Spirit, we welcome your presence also. We are going to be going over some information which is going to stretch our minds. And we definitely need the Holy Spirit's guidance so that we may come to correct conclusions. We thank you in advance for this. In thy name, amen.
Amen.
Okay, we're going to go over five lectures. And I'm still working on lectures four and five because the last two or three months we've got about 20 fabulous articles that we've come across. We being Dr. Michael Webster, he's the partner in crime of mine, a good friend of mine. And he has signed on with me on this project about 6 years ago. And I suppose between us we have somewhere between 600 and 1,000 journals. Articles that deal with this. We haven't sat down to count them out. So it's a collaborative effort. My intent was to give, we're going to cover that here in a second, what the problem is, what can we do about it, and then go on to talk about epigenetics. And I don't know if any of you get Time Magazine. This is the recent one. And they're going to talk about the Aguta rats in here, which is part of what I have planned to talk about. But some new information is coming in that's very, very fascinating. And I think throws tremendous light on how this whole thing could have begun in the first place. We're going to pick up what happens to Adam and Eve, which then is a primary interest to us. But some new information that has come out that may give a insight into where evil originated in the first place. So I'm debating whether to do the epigenetics or to switch over to that, and maybe we'll take a vote later on next week or whatever. So, here are the three main questions we're going to look at. What went wrong in the first place? If you don't know what went wrong, then all further discussion is useless because it's simply spinning our wheels. We have to identify what went wrong before we can go to the second one, how to correct it. So we're going to spend a fair amount of time on what went wrong. And I could justifiably be accused of being redundant to some degree. But the redundancy is there with a purpose. I want to impress upon you the wide spectrum of scientific evidence and support for the premise that we're going to make as to what sin is in the first place. And how far-reaching, how intricate, and how absolutely diabolical it is. And the only way for me to do that is to present to you paper after paper after paper, coming at it from many different angles, so that you can get a gestalt of where we're trying to go. Now, let me just take one moment to tell you the best thing for you to do, or what I would like you to do, is just relax and go with the flow. Because when I pick up pace, we're going to start going through the slides so quickly. If you're going to try to write it down, I think you're going to be frustrated very quickly. And I'm preparing to write a book which would lend itself to careful study and further thought processes on your part. So this time around, it probably be the best. I think you'll get the most if you just get in the ride, close the door, keep your hands and body parts in at all times, and we'll go. All right? The last lecture, do we play a part? And that's really germane nowadays. We have a lot of different ideas out there as to what, even if there is such a thing as the old term sanctification, and if it is, what is it, and do we have any part in it? And that's where I have planned to go, and as I said, we may change tracks a little bit as we get further into this, and I'll let you call it. Okay, we have to have some assumptions to start. If we don't, we'll never get anywhere. So I'm stipulating, I'm going to be giving you a paradigm here, and I'm stipulating that these are the assumptions I am starting out with. And now and then, I find people who don't like the assumptions and therefore wish to leave. You won't hurt my feelings. For instance, the Bible is historical, not allegorical. There's always some people that find that that's offensive to them, and they don't want to wait any longer, stay around any longer for any further discussion because they feel that that discussion would be a waste of time. If you feel that way, that's fine. This is a good time to leave. The first 11 chapters of Genesis actually happened as written. Okay, that's where I'm going, right to the core. People who usually have trouble with the Bible and call it an allegory, take the first 11 chapters of Genesis and jettison them. Others have gone on to say, well, it's Genesis is poetry, and some interesting papers, and a gentleman I met who's a scholar in Hebrew did a very interesting study where he analyzed the Hebrew in Genesis 1 to 11 and compared it to known poetry throughout the rest of the Bible, for instance in Job and in where Miriam, as they cross the Red Sea, she gives her her statement, etc. And they came up with the conclusion that the way the Hebrew was used in the first 11 chapters of Genesis within a 99.9% confidence interval was narrative and was not poetic. And the two languages, when the Hebrews would give poetic, write poetic sequences, the way they used the literature was different from narrative. And but, you know, that impresses some people and not others. So we're not going to bother with that tonight. We're going to say that we're going to stipulate for the five lectures that the first 11 chapters are factual. Yeah, humans possess free will, and the preservation of this free will is God's priority in all of his dealings with the sin problem. Again, that is a very contentious element in some areas. People feel that we don't have free will, whatever. For this discussion, we're saying that it does. And if we were to want to debate at a different time or discuss at a different time whether free will exists, then that's fine. We should have that discussion at another time. It's going to get in our way here if we spend much time on it. And the plan of salvation is capable of being understood by humans, and it makes logical sense. So you see, I put a lot of stipulations down here in advance, areas that I know are sources of dispute. But tonight, that's not our task in the next five lectures. We are defining our task as something different. And all four of these assumptions could certainly provoke very interesting dialogue, but that dialogue should be reserved for another time and place. We have to set the ground rules for what we are going to do and what we are going to accept. And since I'm the one giving the talk, I'm the one that gets the rules, and I just made them. So we'll stick to these. The Bible will be the scaffolding upon which we will be hanging scientifically obtained data. In so doing, when assigning meanings to words, especially biblical sentence written thousands of years ago, difficulties will present themselves. And in a way, a lot of these difficulties with the language are why we have such widespread differences of opinion over even the first four assumptions I told you we just finished talking about. Okay, we take a simple sentence like, I never promised you the money. You can start out and say, I never promised you the money. We can change it a little bit. I never promised you the money. I promised you other things, but I never promised you the money at any time. I never promised you the money. I said I would give it to you, but I never promised you that I would give you the money. I never promised you the money. I did promise the money, but it wasn't to you. I never promised you the money. Okay, I never promised you the money that we're talking about here. I promised you money earlier that was different than what we're talking about, but I never promised you the money that we're talking about right now. I never promised you the money. I promised you the car and the house, but I never promised you the money. Okay, it's the same sentence when you see it written down. The original author who would have written that sentence may have had any one of these or even other ideas in mind when he or she wrote it. And this stuff, the Bible was written between 4 and 2,000 years ago. So we have no way of even getting the originals and absolutely no way of talking to the original authors or even anyone who knew them. So we're at a disadvantage. And we're going to have to do our homework. It also leaves leeway for, again, for people to have differing points of view. The other problem is that the ancient Hebrew and the ancient Greek, which composed the Bible, except for small parts of Aramaic and Daniel, that they all had no punctuation. In fact, it looks like one run-on line of symbol after another. And you have to have a trained eye, and that's why you had to be a scribe in ancient Israel to be able to read. You had to have a trained eye to pick up where the words, and be able to pick out the words and start going down the line and make sense of it. And so you can say a woman without her man is nothing, but when you put punctuation in, it means exactly the opposite. And again, we are going to be asked to put in the punctuation. So we do have some challenges. This isn't cut and dried. You can't sit down and say, well, because a person can read that same text and take a completely different view and have that as their key text also. And it's because of what I've just described. Okay, a paradigm. Number three, a set of assumptions, concepts, values, and practices that constitutes a way of viewing reality for the community that shares them, especially in an intellectual discipline. What I'm suggesting to you tonight is a paradigm. And number one is also something, one and three are the reasons I put the slide up. It serves as a pattern or a model. And with any paradigm that's worth its salt, once you have heard it and understand it, it should provoke more questions than what it answered. And it should predict where your fruitful investigation will come up with even more answers. And that's what I hope to present over the next 5 weeks. A paradigm of looking at sin and salvation. First of all, we have to look at what went wrong in the Garden of Eden. Quick modern day example, if we take the story and I'm gonna fix it up a little bit, I'm gonna give it as my own paraphrase of what happens in Genesis 1 and 3. We live next door to Mr. and Mrs. Jones. Mr. and Mrs. Jones have three children, ages 16, 12, and 8. And they come home one day from school and Mr. Jones, the father, gathers the family together and says, I am the father of this family. I am the person who is in charge of making sure that everyone is safe and that I have safeguarded my family to the best of my ability. Therefore, it is my job to set down certain rules or laws, if you will, of this home, and it is my responsibility to make sure that they are followed and that they are enforced and that everyone understands that it is my prerogative and my authority that rules sway here. So, what I have done as a way to ascertain that the family is in fact cooperating and on the same page of the songbook, I'm going to put two bowls of fruit. And I will replenish the fruit on a daily basis in both of them. They will be fruit that I will purchase and they will be equal. In other words, I'll split the banana. The bananas in half, and I'll put one in each. I'll put the apples that I'll get from the same bin at the grocery store, I'll put three here, and I'll put three here. So the fruit will be exactly the same, but you are only allowed to eat of the fruit of the right on my right, this bowl, you are not allowed to eat of the fruit of the left. Do you understand? This is very serious. I am not playing games here. My authority is at stake. Anyone who eats fruit out of the left bowl will be punished very, very severely. So don't even go there. Well, a week or two goes by, and sure enough, everyone's eating the fruit out of the right, out of the correct bowl, and the other bowl is left untouched. However, about a month down the line, the 10-year-old runs in and eats some fruit out of the other bowl. Because it decides that it looks just as good, and he's in a hurry, picks it up and goes. That night, father calls a meeting, brings everyone together and sits them down and says, I counted the fruit in the bowl you were not to touch, and I saw a piece was missing. Did anyone have the fruit? And after much silence, the 10-year-old raises his hand, and the father said, did I not tell you explicitly that you were not to eat of that fruit? Did you have any question? Was I not perfectly clear? Did not everyone agree and repeat after me when I said not eat the fruit? Yes, Daddy. So you knew you weren't supposed to eat that fruit when you took it? Yes, Daddy. You know that you did wrong? Yes, Daddy, but I'm really sorry. Well, I'm sorry, but you have abridged one of the main rules of this family, and you will have to pay for it. And the father picks up a gun and shoots the son in the head. Now, do you think that family is going to look at that father and go, what a loving thing to do. I feel so much better. I know that you are guarding my household. I know that you have, that it's your love. Out of love you did that so that no one would ever question again your rules. And you're in charge. And we love you for that. And if you're their next door neighbor, and then you hear about all this, and then they come over and they offer to babysit your grandchildren or your children, are you going to let them go over there? If your answer is no, then God's got a big, big problem. Because that's the way most people read the story in Genesis 1 through 3. And if you won't let God babysit your children or your grandchildren, then you're not going to really want to be in his kingdom, will you? Okay, what exactly happened in the garden? We need to go back and make sure that our story is correct. We may have the story wrong. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. And the word for death there, for die, is a verb, which means, in essence, you will begin to die, or it's better translated, dying thou shalt die. So, God is not saying, you eat the fruit, down you go. What he's saying is, you eat the fruit, and you will begin to die at that point. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good from evil. The devil comes in and says, by the way, Eve, just a minute. What did God really say to you? Actually, let's back the story up a little bit. Let's bring Eve into this picture. We've already jumped ahead here. I've jumped ahead of myself. Eve is walking in the garden one day. She's got her pet snake on her shoulder. Snake and fly, and it is the wisest of all of the created animals. And they're walking around, and they come close to the tree of life. And Eve is thinking, I haven't been in this place for a little while. Maybe I ought to have a piece. You know, we're supposed to eat of this to keep ourselves in fine form. And all of a sudden, she walks over to look at, maybe heard a little noise in the tree that they're not supposed to go near of. And she goes over to investigate, and as she gets near that tree, the snake who is on her shoulder flies into the tree, and you can hear her say, what are you doing? That's certain death. And the snake lands in the tree and looks around and reaches over and to her horror, takes a bite out of the apple. I'm sure Eve is backed away and thinking, this is so bad. What am I going to tell Adam? And instead, the snake turns around and says to her, Eve, how beautiful you are today. You know, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you and Adam, how well you have taken care of me. Well, last evening when we were down by the sea, and you and Adam were laughing and talking, and you included me, I just want to know how much I appreciate the kindness and how much that you've shown me and how much I enjoy being around your company. And Eve now stops for a second and she goes, whoa, I was told there was death involved with this. And the snake that I know very well, it's been my pet snake, is now talking to me and very intelligently. And I know it's my snake because it's telling me what we did yesterday. Now, at this point, Eve comes closer to the tree. She's got to see what's going on. And then the snake says, by the way, did I hear God talking to Adam? Or did Adam say that God talked to him and said that you weren't really supposed to eat of this tree? What was that again? That you would die? And Eve says, yes, God said we weren't even supposed to touch it. Now, if you go back and read Genesis 2:16, he doesn't say anything there about touching, does he? It says, but in the day that thou eatest thereof, you will die. Well, the snake then turns around and says, well, that's just not true. If I'm an animal, and I, before this, was only able to express myself by being around you and Adam as best I could, and now I can talk. Well, I bet if you already can talk, I bet if you ate some of this fruit, why, you would become like God. And what the serpent there was insinuating to her was a form of pantheism. There's a force that pervades nature. And this God just didn't want you to eat of this tree because he knew if you ate of it, that the magical powers that are the life force that pervades all of nature, which this tree happens to be imbibed with, would raise you to a new level. And what he's trying to do is keep you down, because that way only he can be at the top. One of the two is lying. But which one isn't? Now, what the adversary was really saying to Eve is, in the view of this new scientific data just presented to you, you have to reassess your understanding of what God really said, or reassess your opinion of it. If someone had been standing there that day with a recorder in the Garden of Eden and had filmed this, they would have seen the snake leave her shoulder and fly into the tree. They would have seen the snake eat the fruit and talk. And it would have looked like all of those were in a line of cause and effect. And you could take that video out and you could replay it. You could replay it in slow motion and it would show the same effect. So now, we need to step back and look at the story and determine what really caused, in that story, what event really caused the situation we're all in today. What if she had handled and opened and smelled the fruit and not eaten it? And I'm not going to answer these questions because you should be able to answer them by lecture 5 with this paradigm. You should be answering all these questions that I'm going to throw out tonight. So you're not going to get an answer tonight. It's a cheap way of making you want to come back. What if she had taken some of the fruit after she'd opened it, smelled it, handled it, and said, I'm going to show God and see what he thinks, but she doesn't eat it? Was the sin in the act of disobedience alone? What if she had opened her mouth to eat the fruit? But just as she did so, as she's got it right between her incisors. Adam comes along and hits the fruit out of her hand and says, Eve, what are you doing? Her teeth never break the skin of the apple. Has she sinned? Would we be where we are today because of what she did, assuming she got Adam to do the same thing? In other words, does intent equal sin? Or was the sin wholly in the breaking the relationship? And by that I mean Eve distrusted God, so she accepted the apple that the serpent threw down to her. So was her then her real problem that she, once she distrusted God, that relationship was severed? And now she is always going to look at him with distrust. So it really didn't matter whether she ate the fruit or not. That was just window dressing. What really mattered was, did she distrust God? We have a problem. We have a problem with all of these, but I'm going to illuminate the problem with this one for just a moment, because I want to keep your mind thinking, and I don't want you to settle in on one, and I suspect if you were going to settle in on one, it would be this one. So, then in the light of Romans 6:23, which says the wages of sin is death, how does one explain Genesis 3:22? And the Lord said, behold, the man has become as one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. What this tells you is God himself is saying that Adam and Eve, who had both partaken of the fruit and now had clearly crossed the line of what was defined as sin, would live forever if they could get to the tree of life without any connection with him at all. So therefore, it can't be a broken relationship, or this statement can't be true. It has to be something over and above a broken relationship. And why would Eve's children suffer because she and Adam had a broken relationship with God? Doesn't Ezekiel 18 say that if a father sinned, the son will not be held accountable? And likewise, if the son should sin, his father will not be held accountable? That's what it says in Ezekiel 18, if you go ahead and read it. It says, the one that sins, he will die. So now what do we do with all of that? In that case, why is it that what Adam and Eve did caused all humanity not only to pass under death, but to have diseases and wars and relationship problems from A to Z? Is the Bible contradictory here? Okay, I'm going to leave those questions out there, because at the end, I think all of you should be able to answer it if I've done my job and presented my material well. So let's now get down to our knitting. First question is, could something physically have occurred when Eve ate the fruit? And the eyes of them both were open, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig trees leaves together and made themselves aprons. They ate the fruit. When a certain amount of time went by, it doesn't appear to be very long, and all of a sudden they said, whoa, something's different. You are naked, and so am I. Now people think, well, they went out and they sold the fig leaves because they were embarrassed. Who else was in the garden? Who would have they been embarrassed if they would have seen them? The animals? They'd been in the garden for quite some time, so I'm very confident that they were well aware of what each other looked like. Marriage ceremony occurred that Friday afternoon. And by the way, some people say, well, Adam and Eve could not have been in the garden more than 40 days, according to Hebrew tradition, because Eve would have gotten pregnant. But that takes a very simplistic view of this whole thing. You know, nowadays we can easily give women medications that will make them amenorrheic, which means they don't have periods. And you think that God would be smart enough to know how to do the same thing? Or, more easily, just don't start the cycle. Or even better yet, since he likes trees, what if he has a fertility type tree where when a couple wants to have a baby, they go partake of the fruit, and it has something in it like clomid, which we give women now who can't ovulate, and they then ovulate, and that's when we get sometimes 4 and 5 babies with clomid. You think if we could figure out clomid, that maybe God would know like something like clomid? And wouldn't that be a simpler way to have run the whole thing and not have women have to have that problem of monthly cycle in heaven? So it's very, very naive to say they had to be there 40 days. We don't know what happened. And as we get further on these lectures, you'll realize we don't know really what physiological capabilities Adam and Eve had, because you're going to find out we've been changed in big time. So to assume there was 40 days is, I think, laughable. They could well have been there 6 months or 2 years. We don't know. One other thing I want to point out here too. We'll get it in the next slide. And then God comes to them and he says, who told you that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded that thou shouldest not eat? The physical effect of nakedness occurred before God ever confronted them and before he ever passed down sentence on them. So if this was God's form of, okay, I told you not to eat any of the cookies in the cookie jar, and we are now going to start parceling out your punishment, the nakedness wouldn't have occurred until God had confronted them and said, I see what you've been doing. Okay, number one, you're naked from now on. This happened before God even appeared on the scene and before God even discussed the problem with them, much less said, okay, you've got consequences. Something changed. And they're putting stuff around them now, the fig leaves, because they realize something major has changed. And they don't feel comfortable the way they are. We don't know what that exactly entails. Ellen White tells us they had a robe of light that disappeared. That very well could be something like, you know, who knows, maybe a force field or just an insulated, like a light garment, which would always keep them warm or cold. If they were running, it would cool them. If they were recumbering, they would always be at 72 degrees. Who knows? We don't know, but we know that they missed it immediately and they didn't like it. Now we have two trees in the garden. Remember, the tree of life and then the tree of knowledge of good and evil. According to Genesis 3:22, there's something in the fruit that is biological active that even Adam and Eve in the quote-unquote fallen state, as they were in the garden, if they had eaten that fruit, they would and continued to eat that fruit, they would have lived forever. So there is something biologically active in that fruit, because we're going to be told that Adam and Eve are going to be quickly, God's going to say, you know, you are going to die. So there's something in that tree of life that is biologically active. We don't know what it is, but it preserves life and big time. In Revelation 22:2, it states, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So there's something biologically active in the leaves. And something when we're going to discuss, probably in lecture 4 or 5, is I just want you to note, in Revelation it says that the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. That tells you that when humankind first gets to heaven after the second coming, they won't be perfect, or they wouldn't need this tree. There would be no need for the healing of the nations to eat of the leaves of the tree if they came up, if they were, when resurrected or translated, were perfect. We need this. Could something biologically active also be present in the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Why is it that only the tree of life can have something biologically active? Why couldn't the tree of knowledge of good and evil have something biologically active? Now, some people who talk to me about this say, well, but that's different. At the end of Genesis 1, God proclaims that everything that he had created was very good. And if there was this tree and it had bad stuff in it, God couldn't have said that. I disagree with that premise altogether. God is looking at the entire creation, and he says it's all very good. And part of that very good is, I have preserved Adam and Eve's right to a free choice by putting something in this garden to allow them to choose otherwise if they want. And the ability to have free choice is God's number one prerequisite in all of his creation. We don't have time to discuss it tonight, but I will tell you, you can take it and go down logically. Without free choice, or free will as we call it, everything that we enjoy in life would be missing. You can't have love, you can't have friendship, you can't have trust, because if everything is programmed in, what good is it? If you have a robot that comes and meets you every day and says, you are the most wonderful person in the world, I love you, you are magnificent, you are so intelligent, and keeps saying that over and over again, would that, after two or three times, it's cute and humorous, after the 50th time, would it matter anymore? The only way it matters is someone that you at least feel has complete control of their faculties comes up to you and says, I think you're wonderful. Then that means something. Anything less than that is zero. It's not even existing. It's simply perfunctorily doing the job. So God's number one goal, always, ever, everywhere in his creation, is to maintain free will. That's number one. Everything else is secondary, and including what happens to you and me. Therefore, I'm saying, if someone still says, well, I don't believe that can happen, we can modify this story here if you want a little bit and say that if there's something biologically active in the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that there is not something biologically active, then maybe God and the devil had made an agreement that if Adam and Eve ate of that fruit, that God would immediately usher them out of the garden, at which time the devil could then do what he had planned. But I think, as I look over the data carefully, I don't believe that was the case. I believe there was something in that fruit. And I'm going to show you why. If there was a biological active substance in the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, is there any way that we can determine that that might have been the case today, as we're here this evening? Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Well, one man is referring to Adam, and the Bible writers were obviously a little sexist. They never included the women, so I will help them out. Wherefore, by one man and one woman, sin entered the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men. What that tells me is that something happened so that Adam and Eve's progeny would all have this without exception. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who was the figure of him that was to come. In other words, even though Adam's and Eve's children did not partake in what Adam and Eve did, they were all going to suffer from it. Now, if that means it's inherited, I don't know any other way to put it. And if it's inherited, there's only one place you can find it. There's only one thing parents hand down to their children: genetic material. If you think about it, a spermatozoa is nothing more than a head filled with 23 of the father's chromosomes and a flagellum that goes behind it. That's it. There's nothing else in there. And the egg on the female side has around it lots of food and nutrients for the new zygote that's going to be formed, so that it can live for about 2 weeks on the foodstuffs that the mother packs around her egg, around it, and the rest of it is the mother's 23 chromosomes. That's it. There's nothing more in there. And when I say chromosomes, that includes the histones and all of the protein apparatus that comes with the double helix DNA. But that's it. There's nothing more. So if it's going to be inherited, we have to find it there. Now, only about 2% of our entire genome, now that's 3 billion base pairs. There's 100, you would get 150 billion nucleotide or base pairs from your mother, 1.5 billion from your mother, and you would get 1.5 billion from your father. They come together, and each cell, therefore, has 3 billion nucleotides in it. And just to give you a little idea of what we're talking about here, there's approximately 75 to 100,000 trillion cells in your body. If you take all of the DNA that's in any one human's body and you take it out of the double helix and unpack it and just string it out, it still stays in two parts, but you're just going to string it out as far as you can and go end to end and keep going, you will have enough DNA to go from here to the sun and back 7 times, and it's 93 million miles from here to the sun. Every human being has that much. If I take all of the libraries, all of the repositories of any printed material, any video material, any audio material that we have in the whole world, and I take all of that information and I convert it over into DNA to store, it will cover about 3/4 of a head of a pin. That's all the written language, all the archived information that we have in any form in the world right now. So, when we're talking about DNA as a information containing, as an information, what word am I looking for? As a means to store information, it is so far without peer that we just marvel at it. Now, only 2% of our entire genome codes for proteins. That, when you hear the word genes, that's what we're talking about. 2% of your entire genome codes for proteins. The other 98%, which used to be called useless or silent or junk DNA, isn't that at all, as we're going to find out. And it's in that other 98% where the real action is. Now, you may not know this, but of the remaining 98%, over 50% of the base pairs have been added sometime after the original genes for humanity were made. Now, if you're an evolutionist, that would be when we became Homo sapiens. We are creation. I'm a creationist, so I'm going to talk like a creationist. I'm going to say, since creation, when Adam and Eve were created, if you look at the genome and you look at their genome, we know that in looking at ours, at least 50% has been added. And in recent literature, they said actually it's closer to 70% because some of it has degenerated with mutations and we can't pick it out anymore. So it's probably close to 70% of the DNA that you and I have in our bodies right now wasn't put there by God. It came from elsewhere. Genomes were forged by massive bombardments with retro elements and retro sequences. The reason I throw this slide in is this was one of the early ones, I think it was in 1999 or 2000 that it was published in Genetica. And this paper was where they started to say, hey, I'll bet these transposal elements had a major effect in evolution. Unfortunately, all of the papers I'm going to show you tonight come from people from an evolutionist point of view. There is no papers whatsoever from anyone other than that. And the papers that I will be presenting by far come from Nature, Science, Scientific American, Genomics, Genetics, Gene, European Molecular Biology. All of these papers, very prestigious journals. And so we are going to have to, when you look up here, do not think that I'm up here propagating to you that we evolved and I'm trying to give that type of a scenario twist here at all. I have to use the data that I glean from these papers to bring for our study later of the Bible. So do not be offended by this nor get the wrong idea that I'm in any way promoting evolution. This was one of the first papers that said, hey guys, we're having trouble with the gene mutation getting us where we need to go from one cell life to humans. And so we need to start looking at transposable elements. And right about this time, the research into transposable elements took off. And we are now, in the last 2 years, we are reaping a cornucopia of information, which we are going to take a little snippet of here later on in our talk. How do we know that the DNA was added? This is a very good question. The code is written differently from the original. And I'm going to just flash up some stuff up here for those of you who might be biologically sophisticated, for you to look at it. For the rest of you, I'm going to just tell you that these are very clearly defined, easily reproducible ways of determining that the stuff, that this other DNA was added. And that is, they have different entrance and exit codons, which is very important. All living mammals, including plants, have a way for the gene to be read. They kind of have an open door that says, come, start here. And then at the end, they say, you're done. And those are all done by code. And the transposable elements, as I'm going to call them, and we're going to be discussing them here in a moment, they have different come in and start and stop. They have completely different start and stop. They have, we will get into it, that there's a lot of DNA in our DNA that codes for viral protein codes and for viral enzymes that are only and can only be used by a virus, have no use for us at all, and in fact can cause disease in us. They have repeat sequences. These repeat sequences are long. They can be long of just say, there's four base pairs, thymine, adenine, cytosine, and guanine. And they may have, T is one of the four base pairs that make up this quaternary code. They may have a string of 10 T's in a row, 3 A's, and then a bunch more T's. Now, the important thing for you to get from this is that the thymine and adenine have a two base pair where they meet together in the middle. They split apart and they're red. And this is what keeps them held together, whereas the guanine and adenine have a three bond. So the DNA is much stronger the more guanine and adenine you have, guanine and cysteine that you have, and it's much weaker if you have thymine and adenine. And I'm not going to use those terms anymore. I just wanted to point out that you can tell by the way that the DNA is, that this junk DNA is set up, it's kind of like someone took a bunch of these letters and just kind of threw them in there. And then made areas where there was long strips where you'd have the same letter over and over and over again. You don't find that in the normal DNA anywhere. And those strips where they have the same letter over and over again cause all kinds of problems, as you're going to see. The code is presented for enzymes that copy messenger RNA into DNA. I'm not going to belabor this, just to say that everything in our bodies was created for the what is called RNA to read off the DNA and bring that out to the cell and have that made into protein. What we find is in these viral elements that come in, there's an enzyme that takes the messenger RNA and makes DNA out of it, which is then put back into the double helix. It goes exactly backwards. And that, again, causes no end of trouble. And here's the biggie. The transposable elements, as we're going to find out, it really were called jumping genes or jumping DNA. They move around. They don't stay in one place. And they take other genes with them. And what they end up doing is they taking your, it's like taking pickup sticks, they take your genome and they just kind of move it all around. Originally, this DNA was called junk DNA or silent DNA. Today, there is a number of names for this DNA. And in this lecture, we're going to lump them all together and call them TEs, or transposable elements. Because that's the overarching nomenclature, that's the overarching term for them. Now, these transposable elements are made up of four different ones. I'm not going to belabor these because, quite frankly, now we're getting too technical and I don't want to bore you with things, except to say this. And I'm just throwing this out as because if we have time later to come back, we will. I think the way, because I'm convinced the devil did it this way and that's why I'm up here tonight, I think the way the attack came is as follows. And I've got scientific papers to match this along. The devil started out with the retrovirus retroposon. In other words, viruses came in and were the lead attack. And these guys came in and they took over the DNA and shut it down and started to refashion it. After these were in place, the next wave came in, which were the transposons. And they are of the DNA origin. They're not RNA. They're different. They work different. And what they do is they cut and paste. Just like in your computer where you have edit and you hit cut and paste, they are able to take sections of DNA and cut them out and paste them in elsewhere. And we are using this right now to genetically alter food and animals, and I suspect somewhere in the world someone's trying to do this with human beings. It's the best technique we have for moving genetic material around. It is by far above anything we ever thought about until we ran across transposable elements. We were doing all kinds of other stuff before, and it was notoriously inaccurate. And people said, how are we ever going to genetically engineer anything? And the only thing they were able to do is put in a new gene in corn or a new gene in soybeans or a couple new ones, but they were kind of incorporated anywhere in the soybean, and you didn't know what you were going to get. Now, using these, scientists are able to come very close to exactly which chromosome, where they want to go, and what they want to put, and if they want to remove something or if they want to add something. It's incredibly accurate. And then the lines and signs, and especially the signs, are what are active in us today. These are the fine-tuning. This is the attack that continues going on as we speak right now, and that is going in our body right now, with our body doing defenses trying to stop it, and new signs being formed every day and coming after our genome. We're going to cover that shortly. The draft of human genome sequence tells us? This is from the U.S. Department of Energy Genome Program, Genomics Science, and Science. And I purposely took their slides so you didn't think that it was something I had made up. And what it says is less than 2% of the genome codes for proteins. I told you that. About 2% are for the genes. Repeated sequence that do not code for proteins, called junk DNA, make up at least 50% of the human genome. And repetitive sequences are thought to have no direct function, but they shed light on chromosome structure and dynamics. Over time, these repeats reshape the genome by rearranging it, creating entirely new genes, modifying and reshuffling existing ones. It's another way of saying, let me just put it simply, it goes into your genome and it rewrites it. It's like taking a book and ripping chapters out and writing new ones. Or taking parts of chapters out and writing those. Writing a new introduction. Writing a new conclusion. Changing the whole story. Changing how it ends. Now, the bottom part, the human, mammals are the ones that are infested with these transposable elements more than any other part of nature, but there is no living entity in nature that is not infected with them. None. Everything is infected. All animals, all plants, all bacteria, eukaryotes, prokaryotes, everything. You can't find one living entity that doesn't have some form of a transportable element in it. And I want to point out, the fly has them, the worm, mustard seed, as far as plants go, rice has the most. Why? Because rice has many times the number of genes we have, and so it has many times the number of transposable elements. You think that was by chance? Barbara McClintock discovered that some segments of the DNA called transposons can move about within a cell's genome. This was 1951. She was the first woman of any repute that had gone into genetics. They didn't think women should be doing this. They should be home taking care of the family. She was ostracized by her colleagues. She had to work by herself. When she tried to print publish papers, they wouldn't do it. They laughed at her. They thought that her discovery that maize, which was subjected to stressful conditions like lack of water, would all of a sudden change color, and you can see there it become mosaic. And when she went and looked at their genome, she found out that the whole chromosome pattern had changed, and the shapes were different, and everything looked rearranged. And she couldn't believe her eyes, and she wanted her colleagues to come in and help her out on it, and they laughed at her. She got the last laugh. She got a Nobel Prize in 1983 because she was the first one to discover these. Now, how did transposable elements get into the human genome? Well, we're going to talk about viruses next time, and viruses was probably the lead way that they were incorporated. But since then, we've also had strong strands of what we call messenger RNA, which have also been able to carry in these foreign elements. So there's two ways, and we're going to look at number two right now, real quickly. And then when we get to the next lecture, we're going to go over viruses, and we're going to really start getting into what this does to behavior and what this means to you and I. They labeled the rabbit endogenous retrovirus that they were able to pull out of the genome. And what they did was they ate it. They marked it, and they ate it. And they measured how much that they put in. They put in 10 to the 14th copies. They were about 250 base pairs long. And then they had blood drawn at 1 hour, 3 hours, and it went on to like 12 hours. And what they found was about 200 of those copies per mL of blood, unchanged. For every milliliter of blood they drew out, they found 200 copies. Perfectly unchanged from what they had eaten, swallowed. And so they did the math and they said, of the 10th and the 14th we put in, 10 to the 16th made it in, into our bodies, into our bloodstream, unchanged. So if you think that everything you eat and put down into your stomach is ground down to the very basic molecules and then is absorbed across the stomach and reassembled, you are gravely mistaken. It gets worse. They made a statement in there. I want to read this. That the relative ease which with mammalian cells in culture can take up and integrate and express exogenous non-self DNA by transfection. What they're saying is they took some human cells and they took some of this rabbit retrovirus transposable element sequence, and they put it into the petri dish with the human cells because they thought, if we've eaten it and it's in our bloodstream, I wonder if it can get into our cells. And guess what they found? No problem. Goes right in. Every cell took it in, said, no, come on in, and we'll even let you go from the cytoplasm right into the nucleus. Welcome. That then led to another paper. And they said, wow, we read that paper, and we're really interested about this. We're going to do something even more. What we're going to do is we're going to take rats, and we're going to feed them the intact gene for green fluorescent protein. That's GFP. And with that, we are going to give them a little mixture of adenovirus. Why the adenovirus? Because it has an enzyme called integrase, which could take that gene if it wanted. It has the ability to take that gene and incorporate it into the mouse. Because just giving the mouse the gene, it could float around in the nucleus and never be incorporated into the genome. And it has to be incorporated into the genome to be transcribed, in other words, to function in a way that genes do in our body. So they only added that a little adenovirus, which has the integrase enzyme, with the mixture. They fed it to the mice along with their meal. And what they found was that fragments of the green fluorescent protein gene or other DNAs were detectable up to 18 hours after feeding by a southern blood analysis. That's just a way to detect that the genetic material is in the blood. But then what they did was very fascinating. They took the animals and they sacrificed them at 18 hours. And what they did was they took fluorescent light and they showed it onto the endothelium of their gut, of their small intestine. See these arrows? You see the little lights there? That's green fluorescent protein that's responding to the light. So those genes, which had been eaten by the mouse, were absorbed through the GI tract intact, got into the cells of the endothelium, were put into the rat genome, and were expressed, making this new foreign protein, which is found in fireflies, surely not found in mice. And it worked just fine. So now that answers the question, could you eat something which could cross your GI tract and actually, if, like I'm fighting a cold right now, so I've probably got some viruses hanging around because I've got the sniffles, and if I ate something today and those viruses are around and it got into the cell with the virus, it could be put into my genome. And it's going to get much worse than that when we get to lecture 5. And that's when we're going to start talking about meat and what you eat. And you've heard that saying, you are what you eat. I just got a paper today from Nature which says, you are what you eat. And you will be shocked. You will be absolutely shocked. I was, to find out how much of what you eat gets into you and becomes part of you. Okay, how do TEs affect the host genome? Okay, I made the argument, and there's plenty of other papers. I just picked two that I thought were very easy to understand and follow. There's no question you can get these TEs into the genome. Okay, so what? What do? They hijack it in a number of ways. And really, right now, if you take most of the genetic-oriented magazines, they are so hot on this because it's going to help them, number one, explain evolution, and number two, genetically engineer everything, that it is the hot rage. It is everywhere in the literature. So, this is what we know about it. We know a lot. It hijacks it in a number of ways. It makes duplicate copies of some genes. This is called copy number variation. It'll make up to 18 copies of one gene. Why is that a problem? Because the more genes you have, you only need two, and one of them's often shut down, either the mother's or the dad's. But if you have 18 of them, and no one's shutting them down, the chances that one of them will have a mutation or be misread and become a cancer nidus goes way up. So copy number variation is very bad. The more copy number variation you have, the more chance you have that cell is going to go cancerous. stop or start certain genes transfection. Remember I told you they have an open door that says start here and stop here? These guys go in and rewrite it. They'll put the stop 3/4 of the way through the gene. Or they'll, better yet, they'll put the door, opening the door earlier than they're supposed to, or they'll say you can only open the door if you have the certain key, and that certain key is only going to be found by proteins that have been coded for by other transposable elements that are in other parts of your genome. They initiate a lot of nonsense transcription. So the cell is firing off this stuff, and a lot of it just gets destroyed because it has nowhere to go. It's like reading a book with nonsense letters. You just place one after another. Pretty soon you look at it and say, I can't make any sense out of this. Let's throw it out. They cause breakage in the chromosomes. How do they cause breakage in the chromosomes? Remember I said they'll have a lot of T's together, and then a couple A's, and then some more T's? Well, the way the chromosomes are set up, they're in a helical way, and when you have a lot of one of those nucleotides, what happens is it gets weak and it bends out like this. Instead of going around, it bends out like this, making a square like a box. And then when it goes to open or any pressure comes on that gene, it breaks. So whole strands break. Breakage is frequent, and sometimes when the repair of the breakage is not repaired correctly, or it's repaired one base pair off, and then the whole gene is lost, or worse, the gene codes for something now that could damage the cell or even cause cancer. They move genes and non-coding base pairs to other areas of the genome. They rearrange things. Remember cut and paste? But not only more that, they cause them to be deleted altogether. And there was one paper out of Stanford that was musing how many genes and how much genetic material has been deleted from the human genome because of these rascals since the original was made. And I remember when I was in college and people were, friends of mine would say to me, well, you surely can't believe Ellen White. There's no way Adam and Eve, Adam was, 12 feet or 11 feet tall and Eve was 10 feet tall. He said they projected that if Adam were 12 feet tall, he'd have to weigh over 1,000 pounds, and the density of our bones can never support that. Well, I beg to differ with him. That's assuming in our present genome the way it is. What if the genes that would have sustained that were lost? And the reason we started shrinking is because we lost certain key genes for bone formation. And it's true, the taller ones were breaking their bones and they were being selected out, and so we got shorter. Or maybe we don't see as well. Or maybe we can't sing like we could have. Or run like we could have. Or do all kinds of things that Adam and Eve couldn't have done, we now can't do. We know for a fact a lot of genetic information has been lost. We don't know how much. So, of course, we can speculate until the cows come home. But that's a fact, Jack. A lot is gone. How do we know? We find fragments of old genes that are gone. All of it's gone, but a little bit. And there's a lot of those fragments around. They're called pseudogenes, and we'll get to those in a minute. They'll flip genes. This is their favorite thing to do. They flip genes, so that now they're reading backwards. And again, that can wreak havoc with the cell and with its ability to make cellular function proteins. And it really controls the genes. I don't have a paper here, but I have one. One of the main geneticists in the United States says that we are really the offspring of viruses. And viruses bring in the key elements. He says humanity has evolved with and is a product of viruses. Okay, endogenous retroviral LTRs as promoters. The promoter is where it says the open door start here. It not only tells you how the messenger RNA is to read that gene, it tells them a lot about the gene, and it tells information where the protein from that gene is to go as far as out in the cell, which of the ribosomes or protein factories it's to go to, and ultimately where it's supposed to go in the body. The incredible complexity of the cell and the genome, I can't even begin to tell you that we would be here for hours and hours and we still wouldn't have scratched the surface. The incredible complexity in the way we are put together is, it's beyond description. I mean, it's all the scientists can do to start even figuring out where some of this came from and where it's going. We still don't know where it's going. Here's the important thing. Up to 75% of human genes use alternate promoters. Alternate promoters are the promoters that are brought in by the TEs and by the viruses that we're going to talk about next time. So 75% of your genes, at least, are controlled by this new stuff that went in. Just on the promoter level. We're not talking about any other level like how it's transcribed. Guess what? They control that too. They control how the protein factors in your body are put together. They have rearranged them so now that they make new proteins that are coded for by this new stuff. So not only did we lose a lot from what Adam and Eve had, we've been remade. First of young retrogenes and independent retrogene formation in mammals. What I wanted to point out here is that retroposition continues to be an important active process in shaping the dynamics of mammalian genomes as compared to being rather inert in non-mammals. It still is functional in rice and all the other plants, and it's still active in the prokaryotes, in the cells that don't have a nucleus. But in prokaryotes, they have something called plasmids. It's the retroposons form their own little ring, and they form their own little circle of DNA. And in plants, it does appear that initially the transposable elements came in and changed them, and then left them alone. They've got a lot of roles. We're going to talk about disease in a minute. I just wanted to reiterate regulation of cellular genes and reproduction. We've just talked about that now pretty ad infinitum. Telomere maintenance, I'm not going to get into that. Repair of broken DNA, I will get into that for a moment. They do have an enzyme that is coded for by these transposable elements that takes broken DNA and puts it back together again. And you'd say, well, wait a minute, that sounds like something God would do, not something that the other side would do. But no, there's a reason for that. If these guys weren't around, those enzymes weren't around, we would quickly deteriorate. Humanity wouldn't have a very long lifespan. And the intelligence behind these transposable elements wants you to live for a while. Because they want to use you. They want to use your cells to make their proteins. They want to, the simple thing is they want to use you for a while, and after you become older and you're no longer useful, then they quit repairing you. So a smart hijacker keeps whatever he's hijacked in function as long as he needs to use them. And if he needs to keep something in the system to keep them alive, that just shows intelligence. And then, of course, we won't get into this, but it's very interesting. Horizontal transfer of DNA is like you have an inheritance from father to son, mother to daughter. And then there's something called horizontal transfer, especially when you get to prokaryotes. There's massive horizontal transfer. The transposable elements in the prokaryotes and in the bacteria are responsible for antibiotic resistance. It's those little rings, and they transport, they spread them. You can have one bacteria that has what's called a plasmid that would make this bacteria no longer susceptible to penicillin. You put it into a culture, by morning, all of them will have it. And even bacteria that are of a different family or species, they trade information very quick and very fast. Now, so I see the time is starting to pinch me here. I'm going to have to move quicker. What I wanted to read was here. Human diseases that they're finding they're being caused by TEs, and particularly the ALU elements, I pointed those out on an earlier slide. I said that's what we're waging against in our body right now. what we're dealing with. That the evidence is growing at an unprecedented rate for them as being the cause of disease. And that in our human, let me get the other one up there too, in our bodies right now, ears and mind, this very minute, we are having, what they're talking about is they took some blood and they analyzed it and they found that recombination in our cells is occurring right now due to these ALUs. Your genome tomorrow will be different than it was today, and then you call it mosaicism, meaning that some cells will actually have a different, the genome will be different than cells right next door. Why? Because these elements are changing and moving things around right now as we speak. So if, in fact, you come to the conclusion, that's at the end of the lectures, that these transposable elements do represent what I will call the sin problem, then we've got it working in us right now, today. It wasn't taken care of at the cross. It's active right now. In you and I. All of the highly active elements found to date are polymorphic in the population, each individual probably having a different assortment of active elements. What I wanted to point out here is we all have a different disease. The disease is the same, but we all have a different manifestation. So if I wanted to come and cure you, I would have to do it, I'd have to look in different places and do it completely different than you. And for every human being, when these guys get in there, they make a completely different attack, and you cannot predict it, and it is unique. So I can't, if I could get an anecdote for you and give it to you, if I gave it to you, it wouldn't do any good. So you can see a problem looming. If you agree with me that this is a sin problem, God's got a real big problem, because for every human being that says, I want to be rid of this, he's got to come up with a unique plan, and he's got to work with you individually. And each one of us will be, the cure will be different. And it changes. It'll be different tomorrow. You see the problem? It looks like it's insurmountable. When I first read it, I thought, there's no way out of this. If this is the problem, we're doomed. But there's hope. There are ways to stop these transposable elements. I just want you to remember DNA methylation. I'm going to talk about that exclusively. And when I talk about that, I'm going to talk about all the other stuff here. We're not going to get into that. That's just some other scientific things that you don't need to know about. And then what I wanted to talk about here is the mechanisms of the environment influences on T activity are only just beginning to emerge. If you are exposed to heavy metals, ionizing radiation, cigarette smoke, anti-cancer therapies, air pollutants, DNA demethylizing agents, all of those are carcinogenic. Why are they carcinogenic? Because of the transposable elements. They react with the transposable elements. And I could tell you each one of those do, but it would be boring. And all you need to know is the reason why you go out to the sun too much and you get melanoma is due to the transposable elements. You would not get it if you didn't have transposable elements, and you could eat all the mercury you wanted and be fine. To a point. Conclusion. T activity can generate a wide spectrum of genetic mutations ranging from point mutations to gross rearrangements with gain of genomic information as well as interference with normal gene processing and expression after insertion. I suppose I could have just read you that sentence and been done. But I told you I'm going to try to hit you with as much information so that you can get a feeling for what we're dealing with here and not just give you one sentence scenarios. This just tells you again, they're talking now that this may be the cause of evolution after all. It wasn't point mutations. Theory that you've got a mutation and it was selected out because it was advantageous. That's gone by the wayside. There's a great book, Genetic Entropy, by R.C. Carlson, that you should get if you want to. He has a PhD in genetics, taught at Cornell, and he came out and said he was a Christian after 25 years, resigned his job, otherwise he couldn't have kept it. And he opens the whole thing from a genetic, the population genetics. He explains very carefully in that book why evolution could not have occurred due to mutations, any which way you want, any scenario you want to take. So now that's why retrotransposal elements have come to the forefront, because that's going to be the new savior. Overall, we found that ALU recombination-mediated genomic deletion has a much higher impact than was inferred from previously identified. What that's saying is, even as we talk right now, you're having deletions from your genome, and I'm having deletions from mine. And if it deletes something that's very important, you could get cancer. Hopefully your body, that's why you have to have a good immune system. Every week, in each one of our bodies, cancer originates at least twice. Our system finds it and destroys it. This is the catalog of diseases. All I'm going to tell you is this. I can show you paper after paper after paper here. The number of diseases it's coming down to now is people are thinking that all diseases are TE generated in one way or another. They're either started, aided and embedded, or entirely responsible for it. And that includes cancer. We have knocked down that at least 45 to 50% of cancers we have proven are TE generated. We haven't looked at the others yet, but the people who are doing it are saying, we think that's going to be the answer. Because now that we're halfway through, and we haven't had a miss yet, it's going to be there. And they're the cause of all autoimmune diseases. That's been known for 10 or 15 years. And due to the shortest of time, I can't tell you why. It's very ingenious just to say that those viruses that infected, let's say, Adam and Eve at the very beginning have been got into their gametes and has been transmitted to all humanity. Every now and then, in some people, they start coding and they make that protein and it goes out and that gets in their bloodstream and they make antibodies to that protein because it's a foreign one. And those antibodies, while destroying the protein, also happen to destroy the myelin for multiple sclerosis or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And so that's how that stuff works. It puts stuff out into your body, your body makes an attack against it and eats itself up in the process. That's just one of the diseases. That's how autoimmune work. And then guess what? Psychosis. It's autism. All of the stuff dealing with the brain is transposable element. Here's, they've mapped it out, and here's mental retardation, schizophrenia, autism, autism, schizophrenia, retardation, autism, autism, schizophrenia. All of that where they have labeled, found transposable elements that have caused it at that spot. And I don't have time to tell you the interesting stuff, taking cadavers of people who are psychotic and taking the brain slices out and comparing the genome for people who weren't and everything. Elegant research. There's no question about this one. And they're in epilepsy. You remember in Matthew 17 where they came down from the Mount of Transfiguration and the disciples couldn't throw the demon out of this young boy who was thrown into the fire? That's the way these epilepsy was originally defined. Is they would throw people around and they would have a seizure and go into the fire or whatever. Epilepsy is from a transposable element, and we'll leave it at that. Okay. They're in the protein coding. I don't have time to talk about this tonight. And we will stop and start here next time. Now, we have 8:15, so I've been real generous. I've given you 5 minutes for questions. Part of that way it keeps embarrassing situations down. If I keep the question and answer period very, very small, that way I keep us
going.
I think it is. It's worked in the past. Any questions right now, or have I thoroughly confused you?
Do you have a feel for what has precipitated the increase in autism in the last couple of decades?
Well, there's been a lot of theories as to why autism has increased. And I'm not going to go through all of the different theories. Some people say it's just diagnosed more. But other people say, no, we got 4 and 5 times the amount. And then there's environmental factors which play heavily into this. I will just tell you, my opinion is, from the basic, something is triggering. You saw that whole list of and that's only partial of transposable elements, and I kept playing autism, autism, autism. Autism is a function of the vasopressin and oxytocin. It's in that system very heavily. They have problems with oxytocin receptors in the right places, and you need those oxytocin receptors in certain parts of your brain or you are not social. And so something is causing the oxytocin system in these people and these young children to be thrown off. We know it's TE generated. What's making those TEs to start activated now can be a host of things, and they can be environmental. But there's a whole, there's as many theories right now as anything. So I can't comment further because I don't know.
You had mentioned meat earlier, and of course most of us don't eat meat. But I did in earlier years, so I suppose that has caused a lot of problems. What, if any, have they discovered about how to keep yourself at the lowest risk for contaminating yourself even more?
Vegan.
Okay.
Yep. By far. And I hope to bring a paper in where, I think I have it here. Yeah. If we go the meat route on the fifth lecture, I have a guy by the name of Varkey in San Diego has done excellent research and actually found something called the glycoproteins, and I'm not going to give you the whole thing spiel right now. But what he's been able to find is that the 5-uramic acid ACGC system that all animals except humans have a different one, and we make antibodies to all the other neuramic acids that we pick up in meat. Now, there's also neuramic acid in plants, and also I should point out there's two things wrong with meat real quickly. One is the neuramic acid problem, and the other is we pick up their DNA. In plants, there is certain chemicals which keep the DNA in plants and degrade it, so you can't eat it and ingest it. I mean, you can eat the plants, but you will not get any of their DNA. And fruit is especially strong that way. And if you eat vegetables or fruit with meat, it cuts down on the amount of DNA that you can absorb from the meat because it binds it. So that's why if you have people with high meat diet and starch have higher incidences of cancer everywhere down the line, and if you eat lots of fruits and vegetables, your cancer drops. And then if you say, no, I'm not going to eat meat, your cancer drops further, but you're still eating dairy. If you get rid of dairy and you're just eating a plant-based diet, it drops to the absolute bottom basement. That's not by chance, and I can show you biochemically why that occurs. It's not a mystery, and when you read in Nature, four atheists who wrote the first article that started it, and they end up by saying, we're all going to become vegans. There's got to be something to it.
Will becoming a vegan repair any of the damage that's been done already?
Do I have a scientific paper to prove that? I don't. But I will tell you this, the way your body turns around, every 7 years, every atom in your body exchanges. Okay? And so, just like when people quit drinking, they actually come back some with their liver and with their other, and with smoking, you never get back to normal, but there's some healing process that goes on. I definitely think that would be the case.
Are there any supplements that you can take? Now, I have read about oral chelation. Things that you can take that will...
Okay, first of all, I've not read a lot about oral chelation, but I will tell you, chelation only mainly picks up as heavy metals.
Okay.
And you shouldn't be eating heavy metals, and then there's some question about whether or not how effective chelation is at really getting the heavy metals, because the heavy metals you worry about are in your nucleus. They have to inhibit an enzyme that your body has naturally made to stop the infestation of transposable elements, and it knocks it out, and then the transposable elements really go to town. What you're going to see next time around is this is an ongoing battle between your body's genome and the invaders. Who's going to get more? And there's all kinds of things you can do, and that, and not the least of which is your activity and your thoughts help wage the battle on one side or the other. So it's going to get real interesting. It's 8:17. I've gone 2 minutes over, so you're excused.
Thank you.
Thank you.